Chapter 4 Lost.
Right, that's it. Another would make it 6.4. Shepard Booger 3.2, are we quit today? Now, the Flutie Quasmi Sanctifier is dependent on an open signal from the coil, but the distance ratio still needs to be confirmed. What I do know is, within such close proximity, the signal from the Helter field is superbly strong. So, let's put this to the test. If I was to be yours, I would love to be away there. Sitting this here would mean, it would mean the probability of any reverse or reset would quite literally be 0.00000000001. What if I were to make a little tweak to the... Oops. What went wrong there then? Wait. Where am I? A dream? Tremens is far from due. What strange madness have I crawled into now? Wait, though. My brow is dry and there is no fever in my bones. Could it really be? Could it? By God, I think it worked. It bloody worked. A success. I've just changed the bloody world. Humphrey Emerson Bramble, I knew it. I said it, I said it, I said it. And what did they do? They laughed. A madman am I? A foolish drunk am I? Well, we'll see who's mad now. Hundreds of thousands of years, debated, labelled and chopped into obsessive little theory cults. This world, our creation, religion sold as firm as science, science as stubborn as a toothless barmite, all of it bloody nonsense, just as I always said it was, just as I always knew. But that does mean I'm stuck. And stuck where exactly? I have absolutely no bloody idea. This looks like some kind of cave, only it's covered in these brightly coloured embers. Quite beautiful, really, like stars or glowworms. All different colours. That were weird. What toxic allure is this? I shall have to be very wary of those. It's okay though, at least I had the Fluty Quasby Sanctifier. But the receiver coil would still need to be reset if I were to have any chance. I doubt that's going to happen. Oh well, Humphrey, old boy, there's worse places to be, and I suppose this place could be exactly that. Wherever it is, wherever I am, we shall just have to explore and make do. This is a most triumphant day. First we log, and then we navigate. Today marks the most significant discovery since the birth of man. My life's work, scribbled and scrawled through pages and pages of spiralling delirium bursting into the new truth. Doubt not the exiled man, for he has time to think, to feel, to see what really could be and question it all. To throw the rubbish out and call hell to his door before backing down a beat. This life, it ain't much for some. It's a bleak and cruel game. For the few that live without burden, without the weight, they only fade. And, just like the rest of us, they pass without so much as a clue to what happened. What it all means, and what it doesn't. That's all just stories, mind games, control, nonsense really. Today, I, Humphrey Emerson Bramble, step from one world into another, harmless and unafraid. The results of a lifetime of questions rising up above the heavy ache of each and every defeat, mined on the beautiful in-between and the infinite possibilities that we let lie dormant, blind to just how magnificent it all is. It's all here, and it always has been. My work's just getting started. There are in life those that wish to dominate and control the days they live to see, first to say I, and last to submit to the silence of an otherwise empty moment. Then there are those that live to observe, watching an avalanche of stories from upon a safe distance, curious but ever so alone. Frank was an observer. His subject was simply the nature of all things. His days were spent a student of two worlds, the shared conscious world where Frank was Frank as night follows day, and two, the limitless realms of his expanding subconscious dream state, a world in which Frank thrived and above all favoured. The nature of the world, or rather perhaps the people that live within it, Frank learned early on was most prevalently fearful. It seemed clear to Frank that these humans simply feared everything. They feared the weather, they feared difference and change, they feared the creatures that dared to live alongside them, they feared their own stories of the stars and the infinite canopy that held them all together. They feared the teachings of ancient, equally troubled men, and so very sadly, they feared each other. In Frank's lifetime alone, he watched the tragic inward recoil that followed the preliminary years of a cyborg civilization. Though he understood little more than the growing presence of flashing screens and vulture-necked pedestrian traffic, he was extremely perceptive, watching on silently as they hurried in regardless, frustrated and unsatisfied, running headless through the mortal door. So why was it then, Frank wondered, that his very own human family didn't seem at all susceptible to this mysterious spell? Basil and Flora didn't own a television. They barely had a computer and Frank never really saw them glued to their phones.
In the evening hours, Frank would curl up comfortably in a cozy corner, purring along softly to the couple's conversations, laughing together or sometimes with company, and often with music. There was a warmth that filled their home, and it seemed to touch any that entered it. The love others had for each of them was beautifully inspiring to Frank as he grew up within their care. It helped to forge his own conscience as he wandered through the world, wide open and receptive, a kitten to a Frank. Biscuits covered the kitchen floor like stones on a seaside British beach. The last 12 hours had left Frank in a torrent of overwhelming thought. The couple were everything to him, and their absence was deeply unsettling. Frank was a creature of routine and rhythm. Any slight shift or change could break the circadian, leaving him anxious and manic. Historically, any time a vacation or small trip was in order, Basil had arranged for Roger to stop by and feed Frank. Roger was ever so fond of him, spoiling Frank rotten whenever he got the chance. These surprise visits, filled with hours of undivided attention, were exceptionally rare, so much so that Frank had grown to quite like them. But Roger hadn't been around. There was no company, and the house remained as silent as a waiting cat.
"Sing loud, sweet silence. Sing clear, so I may know that you are with me. We together fill these ghostly anchorite hours, subdued beneath the curious wake of our nameless misfortune. These lonely walls where once tall shadows played, now nothing more than bare reminders, pitifully meaningless like photos of an empty stage. Am I to run and serve that which fills my gut? Or could this ache be true to measure, one light to lead the lost and lost to love at home again? All my wishes for just that knowing again. But wait. Am I wrong to forget the fable? A fool to deny one's part? Are these days tomorrow until the end? Did I do this? Or worse yet, has something happened to keep my dearest family from me? Are they trapped, lost, or hurt without any help to bring them back? My mind races, turning over and over and in on itself. Voices I cannot clearly hear, warnings I do not fully understand.
Frank sat perched upon the living room windowsill, peering up at the sky through a crack in the curtain. White to grey and charcoal black, the ominous approach of storm clouds shadowing the streets outside sent an excited quiver through his tail. He watched on as a steady pulse of vehicles pulled in, lining up like steam train carriages and swallowing the road. Neighbours rushed to their front doors with bags of heavy shopping, spilling out into the street, birds fleeing simultaneously, disappearing off into the trees and hedgerows, the perfect choreography of chance, unfolding like a private play before his eyes. Frank hopped to the floor and ran from the living room into the kitchen, across the spill of biscuits and out through a cat flap in the back door. Outside, he made a sharp left, turning back on himself and hurrying up the alleyway towards the front garden. Slowing to a focused creep at the front gate by the road, he stopped.
A note. A note. My friend has left his scent so soft yet clear I can't deny. Quick, where else this fragile fragrance fell? The sky breaks. There is silver in the air. If I delay, this turn could wash away the slightest sign or signal. I am the light into this corner, one voice into the storm I must hasten, set aside this hostile delirium, and name my path or forever mark me worthless in the eyes of love. Open up and rain your truth, almighty heavens, I am not afraid.
Thank you.
The trace of Basil's fragrance led Frank all the way to Bramble's Country Town School. With the rain starting to ease, he padded across the car park straight towards the fire escape door, drenched and shivering. The scent stopped there, but Frank had no way in. He pawed at the door, clawing along a slight crack at its base. It's useless. Nobody would hear me. The rain still falls louder than my alert. If he is here, I shall have to find another way. Frank trotted over to the basement hatch. A new, unfamiliar scent, strong and smoky, seemed to drift up and out from whatever or whoever was beneath it. Deciding this to be nothing more than a distraction, he made for the main entrance. A stone porch, its roof much lower than the rest of the building, was flat and concrete, with jet-black gutters running down the sides. It had been built as an extension, appearing much newer than the original build, with its sloping brown and grey tiles running up to the summit like scales on a large dragon. There was one door at the front with repurposed lead windows either side, taken from the old lab building that now served as a PE shed for the school. The main door was unsurprisingly locked. Frank paused, his bright blue eyes surveying the area like a lifelong expert thief. If I can't get in, I shall just have to pick a position and wait a while. See what's what. The moon is out now. Perhaps she'll keep me company. She must feel quite lonely sitting all the way up there. There is will and cleared I see the way. From one small thing to another, I shall climb a little closer to near her light and spend my thoughts in full before this worried night is over.
Frank set a glance upon a green wheelie bin parked against the porch wall. From there, he plotted his route up off the bin, onto the porch, along the side, and straight up the tiles to the rooftop between the chimneys, placing him right beside the Bramble sign. Within little more than a hop-skip-jump, he was up and in position, perching high upon the roof, watching clouds give way to the full moon, silent to the night and hidden beneath the chimney shadow. The dark can be a fascinating place to be, but it's seldom sought after outside of the bedroom, and much rarer than you might think out in the modern world. There's a good reason why it's from where we enter our dreams, and too where we often find our demons. The fragile, awkward moments where we truly see ourselves are common creatures in the dark. Ever sit and really talk to someone in the dark? It's a completely different experience. If you're not already familiar, dear listener, I plead next time you're able, clutch a loved one and see for yourselves. The weight we shed when all we have is the sound of someone's voice speaking back to us is profound. With no muddy lack of focus, no face or formality, with no distraction, we listen. We can actually listen to each other, and from that we can truly start to see one another. Our three friends hadn't seen much in some time. As they ambled on and on, following nothing but the murky glow from their sparklers, fatigue began to set in, and buried questions began to surface, while Skermit shared the story of the young Crumb and the King.
She was found on the line, a young Crumb as tiny as a piddle peep. The elder Crusts brought her back to Hevelton, set her to board at the Crusty Cot, taught and immersed her in the politics of Crumhood, and named her Caucus Crumletter, but we just called her Crummy. Crummy was a bright spark. She took to learning very quickly and grew to know all the secrets of our way. Each and every key, call, and whistle she knew before most other Crumbs could even hold a sparkler. Crumletta was the beloved prodigy of a great man, and with that guard alongside her, guiding her, shaping her, believing in her, she was on a path of greatness herself.
Wait, what? So who was this great man?
A man you both know all too well.
Wait.
Yes. Sergeant Croost.
Oh my, so what happened to her?
The life of a soldier is not a life most would choose. It isn't a life full of fancy or silliness. It isn't a life for the fizzy fools or their dashaway dalliances, no. It is a life of order and obligation, of protection and rules. It is the life of those who forfeit themselves in the service of a greater good. This is the life Sergeant Croost lived. And this is the life he wanted for Crumletta.
I'm guessing she didn't.
Crumletta wanted many things, and she did all that was asked of her. But some things are just not acceptable for a soldier.
Such as?
Crummy wanted to perform. She wanted to sing and to dance, to dream and create. But the elders would not allow it, and neither would Sergeant Croost. He grew frustrated with Crummy, and deeply saddened as she pulled away. Over time, Crummy spent more and more of her focus on silliness and giggles, until one day the elders summoned her to the CCPCC. They ordered her to give up the tow and pipe or be stripped of all her privileges, including her room at the Krusty Kot. Well, this devastated Crummy, of course, but what hurt her more was the sergeant's silence. She fled Heffleton, told only a few of where she headed, and set her path for the corner. Crummy knew of the Twisted King and of the cedars that carried his order. She knew what he was capable of, what he wanted, and everything he'd do to get it. After all, she'd been mentored by the great Kroost. There are few living that know as much about PLCs as Sergeant Kroost does. Few to none. But Crummy also knew of the King's absurd passion for stage. Stories of his weekly collective performances are commonplace in Heffleton. Extravagant displays of sight and sound, consuming more power in one sitting than the whole of Heffleton 1,000 Hevels or more. So what happened when she got to the King? She gave herself over to him, threw herself to the floor, and pleaded for a chance to showcase her abilities. Now, Peelus Lees is many shades of evil, but he is also weak to flattery. He was quite surprised by this young Crumb's brazen plea, intrigued even. Peelus Lees agreed to give Crumletter a chance if she passed all six of his Collective Crunch Camp tests.
Collective what?
The Collective Crunch Camp is a chance for the people of the kingdom to compete for a shot at becoming a regular collective performer. Six long hevels of gruelling step and song. For each of the six, you are to remain cell-bound and may leave only for the crunch. One slight slip and you are out, dragged back to a cell, silenced and forgotten. Crumletter passed each crunch, one by one, all under the scrutinous eye of the King. But on the sixth and final crunch, Peelus Lees called for the Wiggle Snatch.
The Wiggle what?
The Wiggle Snatch is the most ancient dance there is. It was danced by the Hevel gods themselves when they first established the line. It is forbidden, and it is deadly. Ordinary crumbs are not allowed to even attempt it. Any court doing so would be locked up immediately.
Dare I ask, why exactly would such a dance exist? As a dancer myself, I do find the idea of a deadly dance just a little absurd.
Absurd, is it? Well, what if I told you that when danced correctly, it is said to fill the dancer with a great power, greater even than the Hevel itself. But when danced incorrectly, messily and without form, the Wiggle Snatch is most deadly.
Then why in the world would the King request that of anyone? Surely he'd want to master it himself.
Because Peelus Lees knew that no one could guess the steps of the Wiggle Snatch. He knew that it hadn't been danced for 1,000 Hevels, not by anyone and not even by him.
So it was a trap, basically.
Yes.
So what did she do?
Well, when poor Crummy went to make the first step, terrified of the moments to follow, two cedars arrived with news of a prisoner, and Peelus Lees ordered her to stop. He had her dragged back to her guarded cell and locked away. That night, devastated, she cried and cried. She cried for Sergeant Kroost, calling out his name, ashamed of all she'd thrown away and of her own failing to become what she'd always dreamed. But outside her cell, ears listened in closely. They knew the name she spoke, and, too, what that name meant to their king. The following morning, Crumletter was thrown before Peelus Lees. He told her that in exchange for Sergeant Kroost, he would pardon the crunch and award her a permanent placement in the collective. Crummy would not accept. Although she had broken several rules and left the sergeant behind, she would never do anything to put him or anyone else in danger. She was a most kind Crum, but Peelus Lees does not take kindly to rejection. He had her locked away for the further six Hevels, and on the eve of the following collective, he ordered the cedars to bring her to the stage. It was there that the spiteful king made his example, and with the eyes of the whole kingdom fixed upon her, Peelus Lees called the Wiggle Snatch.
So how do you know all of this? How can you be so sure that's what happened?
Because I was that prisoner. Crummy was my friend, and I had to search for her. But the cedars caught me. They arrested me and took me back to the palace, where for six long hevels I was locked in a cell right next to Crummy's. She told me everything.
Okay, stop. I'm sorry to cut you off there, Skamit, old boy. I just want to regroup here for a second, if I may. What is it, Basil? Is everything okay? Yes, darling, everything's fine. Well, not fine exactly. Are we really doing the right thing here? I mean, seriously, look around you. The things we've seen, this place, it's all starting to look right. Basil, need I remind you that it was you who insisted we leave Heffleton, rather than waiting for the sergeant to return and hopefully offer some real support. But that's just it. The sergeant. What on earth is happening here? We somehow arrived in this dark, dismal, dusty old insane asylum, and we've been running around under the directions of, well, breadcrumbs.
breadcrumbs, for God's sake. No offence, Skermit, but we are now marching on blind into the dark, seeking out some other crumb or creature who is reportedly king and who, we have most sincerely been informed, is an Amdram-obsessed murdering sociopath. Are we doing the right thing here?
You're not afraid, are you, my darling?
No, I'm not afraid. I'm just trying to be sensible, that's all.
I see. Sensible.
Right. Yes, well, you know, if this Beelisleys chap is half as bad as they say, then how in the world are we actually supposed to get him to listen? From what Skermit just told us, I don't expect he's going to welcome us in with open arms and say, "Hey there, strange friends, you look lost. How can I help? Would you like some tea?" And presumably his palace is extremely well guarded.
Is it? Is it well guarded, Skermit?
Oh, yes, of course, by cedars.
Well, there we go, then.
Listen to me, darling. I'm sticking to our plan, okay? And if you think you'll be happy staying put here, alone in the dark, while your wife hikes off to meet this dangerous stranger, then so be it. But I did think you had a little more heart than that, my love.
I haven't said I'm staying put anywhere. I just think we need to stop, think, and plan this out a little. We really haven't had a chance until now.
Guys.
We can plan perfectly well en route. Instead of worrying us all into a final halt, why don't you fix that creative mind of yours on a solution to our beyond absurd predicament, or at least commit to the plan we already have, the plan you set in motion. Let's find a way out of the dark, darling, out of this whatever they called this place, and out of this toaster hell we've somehow been imprisoned in. Together, as you promised. Together.
Skermit, what are they?
Who? Flank fillers. Outlaws on the line. We're surrounded.
Flora, take my hand and do not let go.
Don't you dare get off of me. I've got one first. I've got one right here. Get off me!
The day had passed much slower than Roger could bear. Attempts to entertain himself or even spark conversation with Alberto were aggressively dismissed. The school closed at 4 p.m. Monday through Friday, but staff could often be found closing out the week until as late as 7 o'clock. The build-up of day-to-day admin was a common pain point for the Bramble staff and teachers, claiming there was simply too much box-checking to provide the rich education the children deserved. Friday afternoons were the perfect time to collect and vent, running through the he, her, we never, the boy will not go far, everything is bloody terrible, did you know they were having an affair? Whispers of the week, held in empty classrooms, doused in gin and tonic. Though never apart, neither invited, Roger was very much aware of their happening and, fearing Alberto's threat, confessed early on in the day. With the clock approaching 7:30 p.m. and the sound of the last parked car leaving the grounds trailing off over half an hour earlier, Roger was getting twitchy. He knew Alberto would want to move any minute now. He was extremely anxious, and as the big hand found its mark, Alberto groaned.
To your feet.
Right, okay.
Lead the way. Slow and quiet. Do not make any surprises or you'll find your way to the end of my knife.
I understand. I'll only do as you ask, but I will need a little help pushing up the hatch door. It's really quite heavy.
Agreed. Now move.
Okay, I'll just need to get the lock here first. One second. There we are. Now, if you push from that side, I'll get this.
The evening air was cool and seemed to sing softly through the hatch door as they pushed it up and open. The two men paused beneath the weighty hatch, scanning for any movement, listening for any sound. Roger, awaiting directions from Alberto, held his breath, trembling on the edge of instinct.
Now go.
This way. The ladder's just here. Okay, the sign's over there, look.
Let me see here. This post beneath it, where does it go?
I've no idea, just through that concrete block and into the roof, I expect.
It must lead somewhere. It must connect. If these plans are accurate, if you were correct, the sign should turn. That post should turn. Push it.
What do you mean, push it? Push it, what? Push it where? How?
Push it with your hands on the edge. Look, Push it so it turns clockwise. Push it, push it now.
Okay.
Faster.
I can't, it's so heavy. Can you help me? Okay.
As Roger strained and pushed the heavy bramble sign in a painfully slow clockwise mill, his vicious captor glared on incessantly. Alberto's eyes, wide with a brutish excitement, were locked to the sign, fixed on the trembling hands that struggled to push it. So transfixed, in fact, he wasn't remotely aware of the small creature that watched on horrified from just a few steps away.
I know that face. He's in trouble. What evil strikes my friend? What spite? I will not stand by and watch this aggressor wield his dominance in hand and threat. I have seen enough.
Frank moved quick and low to the tiles, creeping over to Alberto's side. From the stretch of the man's shadow, he leapt out, lashing at Alberto's legs, snaking between them like a ratty dog. The surprise sent Alberto out of step and off balance, spilling in a confused tumble, careening towards the roof edge. Frank held on, his claws tearing into the pleats, scratching and sinking his teeth deep into the man's calf. With a gasp, it was all over.
Crumbed, no! What are you doing here, you silly, silly thing? Quick, Frank, come. Come here. Quick. Now you just stay there, Frank. Stay still. Stay by me. Oh, God.
Roger knelt beside the fallen man, extending a hand and two fingers to his neck. As he felt for a pulse, he noticed a small metallic cube, much like a jewelry box with the red light throbbing, lying on the ground by Alberto's hip. With no real thought, he reached for the box and held it in his hand.
He's dead. What am I going to do? They'll say it was me. They'll say I pushed him, sent him off the edge of the roof and into his end. I'll be locked away. A murderer. And all my friends and family will turn away from me, leave me alone and buggered in her majesty's. And oh, God, what am I going to do? Frank, we mustn't wait a moment longer. We mustn't. We've got to run. Come here, I'm taking you home.
Scooping Frank under one arm, Roger glanced down at the strange flashing box in his hand and thrust it into his pocket. With the silent figure stretched out cold beneath the moonlight, he ran.
Here, what do you think he needs?
You think we're in trouble?
I reckon it's got something to do with the lights. You see them?
Oh, well, I heard the evil never sank.
That's what I heard too, but how would that be possible?
I didn't think it was, but that might explain why the lights are all flashing and going out.
I really hope he doesn't ask us to go down there. I'm not a fan of the heat, it makes me dry and itchy. Oh, I'm nervous now.
Look, let's just wait and see. It might not be there, and don't forget what we agreed. You have to ask him.
All right, I know, I got it.
Come on in, boys.
You asked to see us, sir?
Why, yes, I did. Come here. Come closer to me, both of you. Don't mind my colorful crew, they know how to wait.
Now, tell me why all the lights are out and tell me when you're going to fix it. I have a shorter plan.
Well, I'm not really sure if you fully understand the kind of work that goes into this. So let me tell you. I'm up. First thing. Why? Because I need to be. And because I know there is nobody else that's going to give these people what they want. What they crave. You see, boys, I'm a creator. An artist with many colors and a palette only for perfection. But I am also a heaven-sent leader, so let me lead you for a second. Let me whisper in your ear a while. You'd better fix this, and you'd better fix it fast.
What? Come on now, spit it out and don't waste my time. You ought to go straight to the heaven, find out what's wrong, and make it right. Don't even think about failing me.
Understood, sir, but if we were to leave right now, we'd miss the collective. Any chance we could delay?
Well, since you mention it, and I do rather prefer everyone to be there, I will approve your delay. But as soon as those stage lights cut, you must leave. Not a moment later. Do you understand?
Yes, sir, we do.
We do, sir, yeah. Thank you.
Go on, ask him.
There was just one other thing.
What is it?
Well, sir, you see, I've been practicing, I've really improved on my steps. In fact, I've made some considerable progress, and we wondered if there might be a spot for us in the collective. Not this one, obviously, but, you know, sometime soon. Sir?
Are you still here?
Yes, sir. We're leaving now, sir. Thank you, sir.
Gentlemen, I have one hell of a head turning, so we're going to begin again, and you're going to get it right. Because if you don't, I swear it'll be the last slip you ever take in this collective.
Oh? Do you have something to say? Am I too hard on you? Are you feeling tired? I can see in your eyes you hate me, and that's okay. It's fair, because you see, after this rehearsal, no doubt after you've stamped, failed, and stumbled your way through my material, you'll be taken off to a tiny cell, all of your own, where you'll stay and you'll practice until your steps are part of you and you of them are so heaven help me you'll burn. From the top?